Hey, it's Teen. This week's podcast is the recorded audio of a Twitter space that I held with John Peng and Carl Zha. It's an ongoing series of Twitter spaces called the America Watchers, where we talk about foreign policy, but we turn away from examining other countries like Russia and China and towards the United States and how the domestic situation and domestic politics might affect foreign policy, especially vis-a-vis Russia and China. And this week we talked about Trump's survival of the assassination and the selection of J.D. Vance. It went on for a while. What I did was I put the audio of the discussion between the three of us here as a free episode, and then we had sort of interaction with other people in the space, and that discussion, which went on for some time, like over an hour and a half, I think, we'll be putting on the Patreon feed, and if you want to get access to that, just go to patreon.com/planningmag.
Okay, I'm back.
Yeah.
I stepped away for a second.
Yeah, sure. Should we get started?
Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go for it.
John, how are you, man?
Okay. Okay, good. Good. Right. Trying to keep track of that. Trying to keep it up to the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, very significant speech.
It is, yeah. So,
it's a hell of a convention.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tableau, man. It's an American tableau. It's like,
God, times we live in. I mean, you couldn't
I earmarked three topics. The RNC, Trump's speech, J.D. Vance's speech. I don't know if you guys watched that.
So
I thought that was a pretty remarkable speech, too.
Whether you've supported me in the past.
Yeah, yep, yep.
And of course, I know China, how this affects China or the U.S.-China relations and all that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I like your guys' psychoanalysis in our chat group. I think you should talk about that, about how the different dynamics in loyalty. That's it. I'm interested to hear you guys speak more about that.
Sure.
Yeah.
If we're going to talk about that, I think we should start with J.D. Vance's speech, because I thought that was really interesting. And I do think that this is going to be a pretty psycho, it's going to be like a psychological, examination of it, I think, of Americans. Because I think we're all kind of living in like one moment right now, which is different than the recent past where everyone
it's psychological,
was sort of,
yeah. Yeah. And it's mythic. It's psychological and it's mythic. It's story. It's about certain archetypes. I don't mean story in the Democrat narrative, media narrative sense, but in the deep sense. Yeah, archetypal stories about sort of great kind of transitions. I mean, the backdrop to all of this, the inescapable backdrop, is what happened on July 13th. So, and Trump did speak about it. But yeah, I want to get to this, the loyalty thing and so on. And by the way, Trump mentioned it, loyalty. He used that word. And I think there was a part near the end where he addressed, all the different type of populations in the U.S., different communities, right? Blacks, Hispanic, Asian, etc. And then he reached out in friendship and loyalty or something like that, which he's using some words that he doesn't normally use, of course. when we go back to the speech, right? So, that's really interesting. Yeah, I don't know how we order the discussion, but there are a bunch of things to discuss here.
Yeah, I mean,
I'll leave it to you to lead.
I mean, I'll start with J.D. Vance just because I think that's where our discussion, our private chat discussion went. And I just thought it was a really remarkable speech because it was very different than any other political speech that I remember, in that he really didn't talk about politics or policy at all. Generally speaking, you would get, especially now in this age, I think you'd get something along the lines of what a Ron DeSantis or a Vivek Ramaswamy would say, full attack mode. Let me do my, bullet point presentation of how Biden's a failure. Let me slip in, something about how, they can't even define what a woman is, or they're going to, their high school guidance counselors are going to suggest your kid be gay, all this stuff. And
yep. Yep.
Vance gets up there I mean, there's so many of these potentates around Trump to pick, and he picked Vance, and Vance goes up there, and he doesn't say any of that stuff. He doesn't talk about policy. He doesn't talk about, he doesn't ring, you know, use any cultural war attacks. He gets up there, and without summarizing his speech, because it was a long speech and it was not the most exciting speech, but I just saw a person who seemed to be talking to Trump directly as much as he was addressing the crowd. And I started to understand that, or at least I saw a person who was playing a different kind of politics altogether, which is a sort of family relational or dynastic type politics, where Trump represented almost, these are sort of court politics. Like, this was Trump as king, and he was appointed the successor, essentially, and Trump actually made that explicit today. And I don't mean just appointing a VP, but I mean basically appointing, you know, a future MAGA king, right? If you think about what he's trying to say here.
Yeah. And you should reshare or recount the, you should recount or reshare the quote from the speech, the anecdote he shared and the way he did it.
You mean
yeah.
about?
No, because the layered thing. Yeah. The point is that he situated this in a kind of a family, the familial form of power, rather than formal and transactional.
Yeah, right. I'm trying to find you can it. Read I don't know it if out, I have to sh- necessarily read the quote. Mm-hmm. I think I can remember it, but he basically said at one point, he said that Donald Trump is a loving grandfather and a loving father, and mm-hmm. I saw with my own eyes how, you know, when he kissed his...
I can bring it up.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yep. Yep. He's a man I've gotten to know personally over the last few years. He's tough. He is, but he cares about people. He can stand defiant against an assassin one moment and call for national healing the next. He's a beloved father and grandfather, and of course, a once-in-a-generation business leader. He's the man who's feared by America's adversaries, but two nights ago, and I'll share a moment, said goodnight to his two boys, told them he loved them, and made sure to give each of them a kiss on the cheek. And I will say, Don and Eric squirmed the same way my four-year-old does when his daddy tries to give him a kiss on the cheek. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
So I think your reading of the layering of this is worth recounting, because I think that was really interesting. There's a lot going on here in the way he plays with the family, the father-son relationships, and where he situates himself in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah. And I want to, so, I mean, to preface that, I think what's interesting about this is, and I think what we're talking about, John, is a new mode of politics that's going on. And I don't think I think the Republican Party is the arena in which this is happening. In that the Republican Party, I think, is an institution that's has been subject to a hostile takeover by Trump. And Trump is a different kind of politician that has a direct connection with his base. And the kinds of politics that connect and bind the MAGA world together are fundamentally different than the kind of transactional politics we find in sort of modern liberal democratic, you know, modern liberal partisan politics, horse trading. I'll do this, you do that. What if you get me on the ticket? Maybe I'll give you some legislation that benefits your state, and, you know, all this stuff. It's horse trading, right? This is different. This is familial ties. This is the relationship of family. And I think one way to think about that in modern terms is sort of like what we see in something like The Godfather, right? Where it's all about loyalty and family. And if you think about what he says there, Vance, he's subtly navigating family relational politics. What he's doing is drawing a distinction between himself as a 39-year-old. I mean, he's very young. He's 39 years old, and he's been appointed sort of the successor. And he's got to mind these two princelings. He's got to mind Don Jr., and he's got to mind his relationship with Eric. And what he does here is he subtly, using a joke, which disarms everyone, right? The whole crowd went crazy for this joke. And the joke, of course, is that they're still babies when their father kisses them, even though they're, you know, middle-aged men, they're in their 40s. And he's drawing a distinction between him and Donald Trump as men, i.e. fathers, and Don Jr. And Eric as sons, and throwing into that as well his own 4-year-old son. And
yeah,
so he suddenly...
Yeah. I just posted the clip, by the way. Yeah, I just posted the piece. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go on.
So within that joke, which is just a, you know, seen mostly as a crowd pleaser, is embedded this idea that you should think of Vance as someone at the man table and these two fail sons of Trump as lovable but sort of, you know, impotent non-heirs. And so that, you know, that to me is almost like a court move where you're pushing aside the fences.
It's a very, very deft clinical move there. Yeah. First, there's a sort of, he runs the danger of sort of patronizing these two guys, right? And placing them on the same level as his 4-year-old son. And thereby, Vance, the father of that 4-year-old, places himself next to, you know, the big Don.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so this is also very another type of organization, which is very family, right? Is mafia, right? So he's putting himself next to the big Don here. And then in the next move, right? Sorry, guys.
Meaning?
Like where he disarms it and places himself. Okay, I'm one of you guys.
We're brothers. We're brothers now.
We're brothers.
Right? Guys, come on. Yeah. We're brothers. But, you know, he subtly humiliates them, but then... he makes a joke of them, but then kind of draws them in and is in a way saying to them, like, you know, I mean, I read it as sort of like, hey, you know, this was my way to make sure that I mentioned you guys just to, you know, just so you had a place in my speech or whatever. But there was definitely a move. And, you know, I haven't read his biography, Vance's biography, but he comes from a pretty sprawling family. And I thought the way he described his family.
Exactly.
When
we were discussing it last night, when we were discussing it last night, and when you mentioned this family thing, I thought to myself, you know, family, masculinity, that's everything the Republicans want to talk about, right? Or not the MAGA people, there's a lot of complaint about that. And you see this sort of men's movement types, the very online type of reassertion of masculinity. You know, everything from this kind of raw egg nationalist to, you know, Andrew Tate. But these are all forms of masculinity without fatherhood. You know, often without development, which is why some people call them, or they're sometimes known as, you know, criticized as toxic, right? But the Republican notion, whenever they talk about family, you know, to me, it always rings sort of shallow because it's rings hollow because it's nuclear. But Vance comes from a sprawling family. When I watched that, the Hillbilly Elegy, I saw the movie they made of it. And God, this is like some Chinese families. It's like a really dysfunctional family, but it's more like a traditional Asian family. You have all these uncles and brothers and all kinds of kinship relations, which really, really matter. And also the adoptive father relationship matters because he's raised by two fathers, two adoptive. His mama has lots of different boyfriends, and one of them is really terrible to him, and another one is a good father figure to him. So the other aspect, and I think, Tin, you brought this out as well, he's expert at dealing with adoptive fathers, right?
And uncles, and just the whole having a lot of...
Exactly.
Being a younger man within the world of a lot of older...
Yes.
And maybe somewhat dangerous men, or, you know, he's got to navigate a very complicated family life that involves a whole host of men... who could be dangerous, who could be allies, who could be whatever. And I think that's how Vance has put himself, I think, in a position, I think, closer to Trump than anyone else has ever been within the circle. I think Trump, when he picked Vance, I really thought he's going for an heir now, like a successor to this sort of, I don't know how to describe what he's built, what MAGA really is, because I don't think we've seen anything like this before. But this is a bonafide...
Oh, in this speech today, there was a handover thing as well in today's speech.
Oh, yeah, he said you're going to be here for a long time. Yeah,
you're going to be here. Enjoy the ride. Okay. So actually, this is the most familiar form of politics, to humankind. Every monarchy, this sort of relationship in which fatherhood, brotherhood, all these things matter, but it's sort of fallen out of U.S. discourse, sort of fallen out of view in the U.S. in the last maybe 20, 30 years. You know, I mean, we're not talking about having a patriarchy, or maybe even longer than that. But the notion of fatherhood, viewing things through that, you know, not literally, but understanding that among men, being able to discuss intelligently or analytically, throwing some light on how things work by looking at relationships between men in which there's a difference between father, there's father and son, and there are kinship relationships like brother, right? So that's fallen out, but he brings it back quite deftly, as you point out.
What was remarkable about Vance's speech and the way that he rooted all of it in, I mean, he gave a family saga, basically. He talked about repeatedly about his grandmother. He told stories about his mother. And, you know, you could see the crowd instantly relate to this, right? Because this reminds them of their own family. And you see this, therefore, this connection between the family and national level politics in a way that I've never seen before, that this direct relation between national level politics and family relations, I'd never seen anything like this before, because I've in my life, I've only known American politics to be of a transactional sort, which is a sort of dispassionate, hyper technical and backroom dealing. It's deal making.
Just legal, bureaucratic, and deal making, and transactional,
and really impersonal. And now you see this older form. I would call it an older form of sort of I don't know what to call it, but you know, court politics or dynastic politics or whatever you want to call it. And there is this. I'm starting for the first time to see with my own eyes as an American the power of these kinds of political relations. And then we get to today's speech, and then I see Donald Trump talking about his connection as the sort of patriarch of this kingdom he's building, for which I view the report. Look, I mean, Americans are very confused about this, because we just think about it in our old transactional relational paradigm, but the Republican Party is basically now just sort of an asset of this MAGA kingdom with Trump at the top, right? The Republican Party is a mere asset.
It's being reconfigured. Yeah, most interesting thing politically is the reconfiguration. The thing we've been, the three of us have been talking about for all this while, the kind of shifting of the lines, right? Of the ideological lines, the meaninglessness of them, all that is happening. Actually, you're seeing this at this convention.
Yeah,
it's happening on the Republican side.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, they showed this. They put the pictures of what everybody from Mitt Romney to George Bush, etc., all these people, right? And they're completely irrelevant to the party now. Paul Ryan. None of these guys are attending, and they are just. Can you imagine? They'd be totally lost in this environment. So it's changing fast.
I saw a video from the floor of the RNC where Matt Gaetz, who's a Trumpist, harassing the McCarthy, the former Republican speaker, saying, "Are you on the list? Are you on the speaker?" If you, you know, he was harassing and mocking and trying to humiliate him. And what I saw basically was sort of like this sort of second-rate prince of the MAGA kingdom, sort of running around and running interference on behalf of the Klan.
Right.
To him, McCarthy is an outsider who betrayed them, and he's just. Right. He's just taking it upon himself. He's like, you know, his job is just to harass the shit out of McCarthy and sort of start taking more and more territory as the, you know, as this Trump kingdom finishes its takeover of the Republican Party. But that's not their goal. I mean, they're going to keep going. I feel like their takeover of the Republican Party sort of is just, you know, part of a larger plan, I would say. Okay, so we get we have this Vance thing where he comes up and it's almost like the appointment of the crown prince, which is something I've never seen before like this. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And then we get to today.
That's why it's so fascinating. It's like, you know, watching Chinese sort of dynastic,
historical drama.
Historical drama.
Yeah,
Chinese people are probably getting a huge kick out of this, right? And remember, Trump has only one term, no matter what. So they have to go. So you get this 39-year-old guy there, he's got a very long way to go.
You can see, So we get to today, and Trump comes out and tells the story of, you know, the attempted assassination and how he survived. And I've never seen Trump like this before. This is the most humble Trump I've ever seen. But he's humbled by God. He says God was on his side. And, you know, regardless of here's the thing. It doesn't matter what you believe. The point is that a lot of people see this as a miracle. What happened was
it's a political miracle.
I think of it as the Pulp Fiction scene where the guy that they missed in the beginning comes running out of that bedroom with a Magnum 357, and he's from 10 feet, empties the gun, and every bullet misses them by a centimeter. You can see the bullet holes sort of right around their head. And then at the end of the movie, you see Jules Winfield, played by Sam Jackson, having a debate with Vincent Vega, played by John Travolta, about whether this was a miracle or not. And I thought, actually, that was really well-written dialogue, because what Jules says, what Sam Jackson says, is it doesn't matter it doesn't matter if it was an act of God or supernatural or not. What matters is I felt God, right? And that's exactly what Trump said. And you know what I think happens in that moment, and I've never seen this before in American politics, and I saw it with my own eyes, and I was like, that completes the circuit, because Trump now has the mandate of heaven. He got the mandate of heaven. Carl, what do you think? Trump has the mandate of heaven.
Without question.
I mean, among that crowd, yeah, for sure. This is
among the crowd. That's what I mean.
The Tucker Carlson also made reference to it. He said, God is among us. I think most people there believe it. I think you guys are onto something about this has been more like kind of the traditional, the traditional order of leadership, right? It's about allegiance, loyalty, familial ties, and this is for thousands of years. This is what a lot of human society are organized around.
And like you say,
you know, this is just like those Chinese dynastic core dramas that's catnip to like Chinese audiences. It's also involved a little bit personality cult, like, you know, see how Tucker Carlson built up Trump, like this, he's the bravest man, you know, that's why he should be the leader, and like he is gonna
you have warriors like Dana White coming out, you know, like a Roman centurion, you know, saying the bravest warrior in the land, claiming that Trump is even tougher than him. But then see, the problem, so I think the problem with this setup for a long time for the MAGA world was that it all came down to Trump, and Trump, therefore, in a way, he didn't sit at the top. He sat at the bottom of this. And if his opponents, I wouldn't say the Democrats, I think there's a lot of, there's a lot more than just the Democrats here. I think the establishment in general is going after him for reasons. But I think it all was coming down to him. If he fucked up, the whole thing falls apart, right? But then what does he do?
If the assassination attempt had gone the other way, if Trump didn't turn his head at the last moment, you know, that would have been it. That, you know, the RNCs, I'm pretty sure the establishment Republicans are gonna get their candidate, like someone like Nikki Haley, to be the Republican nominee, and then Democrat might actually win, you know. The established, it's going to be establishment versus establishment again, and people will lose interest.
Each Biden, side would replace, there'll be a cleaning of the of the board, across the board. Each side would replace the old guy, and it and business resume as usual.
But then July 13th happened. And I got
June 13th. Is the thing at the center of all this. I can't help but notice how Trump, as you mentioned, this character, right, that Trump resembles. I mean, he has, you know, his entrances into this and his presence at this RNC is just, you know, incredible.
It's like something out of
anything like that. You've never seen him like that. When he walks into the hall, right, he makes his entrance. It's not like the old Trump who came in and he had to assert power. You know, this is the biggest braggart and swaggerer on earth. And he knows how to do that. He's really good at doing the swagger and so on, right? The walk, and he comes in and a powerful guy. No, this is a guy being borne along by power that is no longer has to assert. It's outside of him. This is a mythic moment. This is when you go next level, you know.
Yeah, and I think
and understanding
it
what happened
a lot of problems
on
for him, right?
Of because it's all wrong for him.
Because in a way, I think his look. I don't care. I believe that he's going through a genuine moment of some sort of. He's having some kind of moment here. Having survived the assassin's bullet, right? He's having some kind of moment. It's an overwhelming experience, not just surviving it, but the closeness of it and the outpouring.
That speech, I was wondering how he would handle it in that speech, in tonight's speech. And that part where he said, I'm never going to talk about this again. But here's my account of what happened.
But you know what happened? I think if you want to go, let's go back down to the terrestrial level in terms of the politics involved here.
Yes.
I mean, I, as a pagan, as a heathen American who absolutely, I've never seen the actual anthropological or mythical, whatever you want to call it, I've never seen religion and God insert itself into politics the way I saw in this speech, which is
exactly
a man who says, you know what, I'm not really a human being. I am human form. But I seem to have a divine purpose. And so my personal faults, that's completely irrelevant. I was chosen by God. I was chosen by God. So I'm not even human anymore. Do you see?
Yeah.
And I think that solves a political problem for this type of politics, which is to say that the patriarch is the most humble among us in that he's the one that is being talked to by the power that rules over all of us, which is God. And, you know, that really completes...
No, you rise to true power. You rise to a higher level of power, to sublime power, something understood very well in Asian civilizations, right? The great power is not the executive You're not necessarily the executive power. You're not the guy necessarily directing things or pushing things. You sit there. You are the axis of power. This is the kind of thing you see a lot of in Southeast Asia. You don't move. Others move because you don't have to. You are the center of power. It's very much the same with Chinese emperors. So, and you know, you can talk about you know, in Taoism, at least in philosophical Taoism, Tao Te Ching, for example, it begins with this sort of notion of power. It's not just about personal cultivation. It's about understanding that power, that you don't, the one who is most powerful doesn't have to do, right? Wu Wei. So you, And it's certainly, you know, I'm married to an anthropologist, right? You know, in Buddhism, for example, they distinguish between the person with the function of executive power and then the power that's at the center as well. So this is really quite fundamental and something not well understood, or it's invisible in American politics. And these are universal things, just as like the family thing is universal. They don't always have to be overt, but at least people have to understand them. And in that Vance thing, and in the way things are working out right now, this is coming back to the fore again, isn't it? It really is at the core of it. And with Trump's speech, Vance's speech, and Trump's reactions after the speech, after the assassination attempt, what's as significant as what happened or what is said is what hasn't happened and what they have not said, what Trump did not do. He described this moment of having the bullet go right by him. And then afterwards, you know, he realizes it's serious. Somebody wants to kill him. He goes down and then he describes a serenity. This is a word I don't think I've heard him.
Yes, he did say that. Yeah.
I don't think I've heard him use. First of all, he begins by prefacing it with a moment of vulnerability that, again, I've never seen him adopt. I'm not going to talk about this again because it hurts so much. And then he goes down there and there's this moment of serenity. Now, these are bullets flying around all over the place, Secret Service agents throwing themselves at you, and then you have this serenity. I mean, this is, again, this is, rings rather true to the experience of phenomenologically, people who have been, you know, time sort of slows down, everything slows down, and unexpectedly, instead of panic or something, he feels this kind of serenity, and then that's the moment he feels that something, you know, he's in the hands of something greater. But the moment when he rises again and he does that, and he makes it very clear, it's not about him alone, it's him and the crowd, him and the people, hence the necessary humility, it's about him and the people. That's absolutely iconic, absolutely mythical, which is why we say, I mean, I can say, look, this is, it's beside the point what the man is about. The man has been overcome by the archetype. In this case, you could, in Greek terms, you could view it as the hero archetype, for example. You know, the other days, the guys at the Duran, who are both Greeks, for example, were talking about it. You know, Mercurius said, look, this is, take it from us Greeks. This is the hero. So hero isn't about who you are, you know, it's about all your little peccadilloes or all your, you know, your all your little personal psychology. You exist on a mythic level. You've been touched by the gods. You're more than just human. You don't have to believe in, it's not about supernatural. It's about, you know, this is described very clearly in religious anthropology, the overtaking of your personal, the description of things that requires something more than just describing people's inner states, you know, just these rational transactional agents. No, he conforms to a certain type that's really quite powerful. He's more than himself. He definitely is more than himself. What we think of him matters as much to this configuration of power, you know, as anything else, right? I mean, he stands up there, and when he rises and he does that thing, I mean, and he says fight, it could have gone either way. He could have turned this into something divisive. He didn't. He could have taken the path of, just hatred and revenge and so on, but he didn't. And that's pretty remarkable. in his speech tonight. I was wondering whether he would follow through on his speech tonight, and he began by saying, you know, it's not a victory if we win only half of America, right? Yeah. What do you guys think?
Tucker Carlson actually pointed that out. He actually pointed out to the fact that Donald Trump could have seized a moment and turning into a very divisive atmosphere by questioning why is it, but instead he just accepted. He took it with grace, and this is like you say, he's becoming a man of destiny now. Like
for
common people, for normies in America, you know, the way they understand things, pop culture or movies. So I'm going to put it in the terms of the latest popular movie, Doom, right? It's like in the movie Doom, Paul is now become Muad'Dib, right? He's not himself anymore. He's fulfilling a destiny, a path that was laid out for him. And everyone expect him to follow. Yeah. So, what I'm really surprised is how much the failed assassination just totally legitimized Trump. Because before, if you remember, for the last 4 or 5 years, Trump, the whole mainstream media is about not only delegitimized Trump. I mean, even dehumanized.
Demonized.
Right?
Dehumanized.
He's like the untouchable, the devil, the big the Hitler reincarnate, right? He's not one you can introduce to the polite company. And yet after the failed assassination, what happened? All the establishment figures are forced to sending condolences and saying we are against political violence, and then all the head of the
state by calling him Hitler.
And all the head of states from other country, even Xi Jinping, you know, Maduro, I think Putin as well, everyone is sending in their condolences, their greetings for president, and their concerns for former President Trump. So suddenly he's being elevated, right? He's being elevated from this like deplorable, the leader of the deplorable, to be acknowledged as the former president of the United States and as a possible future president of the United States. And I think for a lot of his Trump's follower, it's a validation, because they feel like they have held on to their belief in Trump the person, and now all of a sudden this is all getting validated. You know, this is being acknowledged by world leaders and by their enemies. You know, Trump is now unstoppable, right? I mean, but I'm gonna play devil's advocate here. Okay, so we need it. If the election is held today, I'm pretty sure Trump would win, right? I think most people would agree. But we're still 4 months away from the election, and in American electoral cycle, 4 months is almost an eternity. You know, a lot of things can happen,
dude. In 2024, 1 week is a lot. I mean, it's not just American electoral cycle. This is the time of the bizarre, right? This is the time. This is pandemonium. The release of all the demons. This is a crazy time. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, right now, yes, the Democrats are in shambles. They're scrambling. They're trying to get Biden to resign, to give up his nomination. But I mean, anything.
Carl, Carl, it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, this is the best season of America ever, and there's so much going on, but we're really only in episode 4, and it's an 8 episode season.
It feels
like the great climax happened in episode 4, but the fact that there's 4 episodes remaining tells us this ain't, you know, we don't know the ending of this yet, right?
Yeah, we should still be watching this serial, this 80-week serial, this 80-episode serial.
Yeah,
that's just all it means.
At the minimum, Trump have to survive those 4 months, okay? I mean, like...
Exactly, physically survive.
I'm not saying, like, you know, his assassination was planned by Deep State, but if he was, you know, they're not going to just stop at a failed assassination. And if he wasn't Deep State, there could be copycats, you know, like now anybody can see this.
Absolutely.
As a, you know, the 15 minute of fame, you know, they can become famous overnight by making history. And so Trump first has to survive, because right now a lot of the momentum of the Republican Party is riding on the person of Donald Trump. You know, like, none of the other people can. I mean, maybe J.D. Vance, I don't know. Like, I know there's a lot of excitement about J.D. Vance right now, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. How important really is?
Oh, I mean, he just showed up in this series, so they're going to need to develop his character a little bit before he plays a big role. So I wouldn't expect.
But,
by doing the family thing
and the son thing, he starts to place himself within that mythic space. He's not just the VP.
No.
If he's the son of the guy who's gone into... Yes, because what happened on July 13 is not something you can explain incrementally. It's something that, you know, using liberal terms, just doesn't compute. It's a phase change, right? The guy went into God mode. You know, he leveled up, right? Yeah. Well, he went into God mode. There's no denying that. I mean, he could still be killed off later at some point. You know, things could change. But there's no denying what just happened. And then this JD guy is smart enough to put himself into that. Or events are working out. The logic of the situation is working out in such a way that he's being almost anointed as well. Usually you have the anointing. These things are the RNCs, the anointing of the president. But you almost implicitly see the anointing of a kind of lineage. And as Tien says, now you can see a way forward for the movement. Now there's a future for it beyond a person, you know, a single individual. That's really interesting.
He's a crown prince now. He's an heir. Yeah, he's an heir to the movement. He's a crown prince.
And by the way, neither of them mentioned, you know, we're in the middle of all this swirling talk, right, about the assassination attempt, this totally bizarre level of either of incompetence and around it, and the real suspicion, justifiable suspicion, that it was a setup. And I think people there, even I've heard talk from credible people, even at the RNC, really, really worried about exactly what Carl is talking about. They could still take a bullet.
They're not done trying to kill him.
They're definitely not done, right? Yeah. There's this rumor, for example, not rumor, there was this pointing out about the short selling on the market, right, of Trump stocks just before this. But also people saying that the RNC was prepared for a convention without Trump. Hmm. That it's not just the Democrats who might be wanting to get rid of him, that within the RNC... You know, I'm just relaying this, right? I'm not saying that I propose this, because it all sounds kooky and bizarre now, but that there are people in there that want to get rid of him.
Why does it
from
sound
within the Republican side as well?
Wait,
so Walter Kern was talking about this.
Why does it sound kooky and bizarre?
Yeah, because people think it's just the Dems who want to get rid of him, but often it's the guys within. But that you have a deep state. If there is this deep state thing, it runs across parties. And those guys want to get rid of him. And I mean kill, right? Stop at all costs.
I think so there's enough questions that are being raised that are very credible. Yeah. I mean, like, yesterday, ABC News, ABC News reported, I guess that means that the timeline, because there's so much documentary evidence of the event. And they're able to synchronize it using audio and other events.
Yeah,
like, they're able to take all the they've taken a really good job taking all the various video.
Yeah,
loads of video. I mean, everyone had a cell phone recording.
Yeah. This is like JFK assassination with everyone with mobile phones. Yep.
Everyone was Zapruder, and everyone had a high definition camera with, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they've been able to stitch together a timeline of what happened, and ABC News reported that the Secret Service snipers saw Crooks on the roof at 5:52, which is 20 minutes before the first shot.
Yeah.
And that was That wasn't 4chan. That wasn't a Reddit rumor. That was ABC News.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their own timeline.
And the local cops saying that, that they spotted that him on the roof, right? And announced and it on yeah.
And that was before Trump took to the stage. You know, nobody bothered to delay Trump from getting that stage, even after they have become aware of the presence of a possible assassin.
Yeah.
And not the local cops.
He never mentioned any of that. In Trump's speech, not once did he bring that up or any suspicion. He only praised the Secret Service. The man understands the moment and he focuses on it. I don't want to use the word moment now. It's completely ruined. But he understands where, you know, what's going on, right? He understands his context of power, this the new kind of power he wields. And he blows by it, but it's real. This yeah, please continue talking about this event because it blows my mind, this assassination attempt.
Well, I think that
Trump definitely knew how to seize a moment to leverage this advantage. Yeah. I mean, you saw that after he was
fucking genius.
At the moment when the Secret Service was about to like get him off the stage, he stopped them to pump his fist in the air because he knew, you know, that would be a defining moment and say fight, 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 and that, you know, with that photograph capture with American flag in the background, and that just become iconic. And you know, he's a media person. He knew how to make himself look good. I mean, I have to give him that. And he's really, I mean, he has become come across as mature and presidential by not encouraging more division. You know, now he mm-hmm. he became like mm-hmm. he's magnanimous. You know, he's mm-hmm. forgiving. He's actually a reasonable person.
Yeah. The argument in favor of this new Trump being something thought through, more thought through and originating before the 13th is that during the debate, his conduct of debate with Biden, he held back. This was a more considered, different Trump. He held back. He let Biden sort of do his thing. He didn't have sort of low blows on the guy's senility, and afterwards he just kept silent while the huge kind of controversy was around Biden raged. He was smart enough to just shut up and not become the topic of conversation. So much so that Biden said to donors, right, it's time to put the bullseye on Trump. It's time to turn the conversation back on Trump, right? Apart from that being an offensive metaphor, a terrible one in retrospect. But so that's the argument in favor of the guy being that move, his standing up being more considered. I tend to think that however good your grasp of optics and so on, there's something preternatural, there's something beyond in rising up from having your head almost sort of blown off and doing so-called the right thing. It's the moment, it's the archetype taking over the man. Let me give you an example of this, right? So in anthropologists, right, they when they talk about rites of initiation, right, in which a child, a boy becomes a man. There's this analysis, famous three-part analysis, right? First by Victor Turner, in which you have a prior stage, you know, a stage of separation. You take the kid, you take the person you want to initiate out of society, you take him out of the normal, right? And then this moment of separation involves some kind of act of killing or persecution or punishment. It's just like an act of ritual killing by your elders so that this person just becomes, it's gone. The old is gone. And then the subject, the kids being, the boy is being initiated, they exist in a kind of liminality. They're neither here nor there. This is a very powerful state. You're neither here nor there. And then afterwards, they're reintegrated. I was watching the Trump thing up to the RNC speech with that structure in mind. the separation, so to speak, from the human, from normal Trump, normal world, is the bullet piercing his ear. After that, you don't know where the guy is. You know, he is in exactly that liminal state. He's neither here nor there. He's no longer what he was before. And then you watch and see what he becomes, what he is when he returns as the man, in this case, quite literally, when he returns and he's reintegrated. So whether or not you take, I mean, that's just the model for rites of initiation, but you can take an analysis like that, different types of analysis you can apply to understand that, well, something beyond just calculation is involved in a figure becoming what Carlton calls the leader or the hero or a kind of power. So I think we just witnessed that. This is not a judgment about how good this guy is in person, but you know, it's not a judgment about Trump's character. Something big has happened and overwhelmed him.
What you're saying is an endorsement or anything. I think what this is understanding, like, okay, I think there's been a meme circulating that I'm starting to understand more, which is frustration with what they call the nothing ever happens guy.
The nothing.
Okay. Yeah. Meaning that no matter what the hell happens out there in the world, no matter what bizarre set of events, if you're writing out this script as a show or a movie or a book, that event on July 13th would be called a Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah. Deus Ex Machina. Yeah, that's exactly.
I mean, we would call it that because it's so improbable and the effects of it are so massive that in a literary sense, it's a Deus Ex Machina. Okay?
Yeah.
And it happened. It happened. We had a real life Deus Ex Machina because if it was fictional, that's what we would call it.
Yeah.
And it changed the nature of an election that's taking place where we're literally on the brink of some – we're literally on the brink of multiple existential disasters on Earth, okay?
Yep, yep.
Now, here's the thing. When I see this happening, I myself – feel like, okay, you know what? I'm witnessing something happening. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But I think that I'm starting to at least pay attention to events in the sense that the nothing ever happens view is just wrong. A lot of things are happening. Yep. And I think that the nothing ever happens guy is someone who feels powerless and therefore how do I put it? I think nothing ever happens guy is someone who wants to — hey John, there's a lot of noise on your end, so you could you can mute when you're not talking because I think there's a lot of background noise. But I understand it. I sympathize with it, which is this belief that I kind of have to justify my own apathy and disgust, because for so long, politics has been such a — I mean, and it's still, I'm not saying it's not, but it's been such a goddamn show. Like, it's in the sense of it's just pure production, fakery, lies. And
you're afraid to hope for anything, too. I think you're also afraid to hope for anything. You've been disappointed so many times. Right. Yeah, you're afraid to even hope for deterioration.
And you're a foolish person to put any faith in politics where, you know, I think the attitude of the nothing ever happens guy is one of sort of a smug superiority to say, you're a fool for thinking that any of this is significant, right? Which I understand, and I kind of feel a lot of that myself, right? But I think that the opposite, what we're moving towards, at least with the sort of like dramatic uptick in improbable events, is not the old set. Like, it's not the traditional transactional political motivation of saying, hey, you know what, I should get out there and I should, you know, I should get behind a candidate and I should throw in, maybe I'll run for office or maybe I'll, you know, volunteer for a campaign. I'm going to get politically active. I don't think it's that. I think what's going on more is just sort of like a, for me anyway, is like an intense interest in what's actually happening as real. Like, these are real events. They're not manufactured. And I think one of the first things that it came out of the mouth of the Nothing Ever Happens guys, of which I know plenty, was that this whole thing was staged. There's no way this was real. Trump staged this for his own benefit. I think that was the immediate response.
For real. You can't this trust it real. Anymore.
Yeah. I think the Nothing Ever Happens guy is a person for whom they've lost all faith in reality itself. Everything is a show. Everything is a scam. Everything, you know, is fake. And I don't blame them for it, because that is true for a lot, you know, for most of politics. So I don't blame them. But on the other hand, I think, you know, it is kind of limiting to think of recent events in those terms. I think something really is happening. And I don't know what. And I am just...
I just find myself legitimately
interested in what's happening.
You couldn't script this. Carl is right. You have to use kind of movie or novel, analogs or games, but, you know, to see this in real life. I mean, the guy literally, he comes down, you think he dies, right? There's this, how many seconds is it? 15, 20 seconds when you don't know what is happening and he's down there and then he rises again. What is this man? This is like, you know, the guy, it's like Jesus, right? You can't make this up.
You know, the more remarkable photo is
he
gets not
hit,
the,
he
is
goes
the
down and
photo.
He comes up and he's different. That's just the structure. He comes up, he's different, and now he's untouchable. If you say nothing happened, then I don't know how to help, because, you know, I think everything has if a single event could have changed things, this is it. I mean, if particular events and moments could be quite powerful. We've just seen one. Yeah. And it's hard to process, actually.
I was very interested in how a lot of people I know, my friends included, that there was this widespread dismissal of the events as stage, as fake. And still, I think they're kind of clinging on to that belief. And, you know, I think, honestly, and I'm getting a little bit fucking sick of it, is that... And I see this a lot on the left, okay, is this inbuilt personal smugness about being depressed and about feeling, you know, just that just total cynicism is the only proper way to exist in a righteous way, is to be depressed and without hope. And I'm not saying I'm putting hope in events, but I'm saying that things absolutely are happening. And I'm starting to realize, like, depressed people are very interested in...
Yes, cynicism is not...
Cynicism...
It's a really negative, useless affect, really.
Not only is it useless, but it...
Cynicism is just leads to apathy.
But it wants to spread itself. That's the worst thing about cynicism... Yeah. Is that it wants company. And so it has this
exactly
bullying and effect of denigrating anyone who sees significance in events.
Yeah.
Because it wants everyone to see no significance in any of this. And that is the smart view. That's the smart, radical view, is all of this is theater and bullshit. And so why pay attention to it? And I would say that, in fact, actually, I think that's how traditional transactional politics wants you to be. They want, see, part of the whole boredom of centrist politics that has dominated the era, modern era, let's say ever since, God, since, I mean, maybe not since quite since Kennedy, but at least since George Bush the first, right? Is, you know, they want you to be bored by this talk about tax and regulations, and they want you to be bored by this talk about inflations and the unemployment rate and stuff. They want you to throw your hands up and be like, well, none of this shit matters. You're all the same. You're all the fucking same. And that's what they want from us. And it was true. It was true. I think what I'm seeing now, anyway, again, I don't know if what's happening with the in Trump world is a good thing or whether this is going to lead to disaster. I have no idea. I mean, all narratives are about suspense, right? But I would say that what's going on now, I think, is a really, really significant change in the way politics are conducted because of we're seeing, I think, the collapse in the liberal framework. We're seeing a collapse in their economic model, which is running on monetary fumes and is becoming predatory. It's becoming a rent-seeking type economy, not a productive economy. We're seeing just a lot of people burn out. I think I recommend people read Byung-Chul Han's Burnout Society for a good description, I think, of this concept of burnout and why that's happening en masse. You're seeing, and I think the right wing is correct to point out a lot of the social pathologies, like well, I don't know about pathologies, but indicators like declining birth rates and things like that. And there's a mass loss of interest in transactional politics. And I think what's sweeping in to fill that vacuum is these really archaic forms of dynastic or court politics that's built around, again, things like loyalty and God. And I'm seeing it in action. And these are not buzzwords anymore. I'm seeing them actually use these things in, I think, the way that it's always been used to legitimize this sort of like power structure that they're building. And it is not based on anything that any of us really quite recognizes. Like, we haven't seen these forces in America in a long time. And my point is that we shouldn't sleep on this as insignificant or just mere bullshit, you know, more fodder for CNN, more fodder for Fox News so they can amp their ratings. This goes beyond that, in my opinion.
Yeah, the other side is just going to call it fascist.
Who is the
associate family
who is
with
this guy for the entire time we've been doing this has just been going thumbs down. Hilarious. Yeah. I think it's a never.
The other side is just going to call it
nothing ever happens kind of guy.
Yeah, I mean, people are just going to call it fascist, and there's a
maybe it
you
is.
Know,
maybe it is. I don't know.
There's a way about of using notions like family, God, and so on. A particular way which is linked to fascism. But there's also a way in which these things animate the political or the question of leadership and governance, which isn't. It's important to know the difference between the two, because I'm not saying that it's going to all go in a great direction. But I didn't see it as all bad, you know. The spirit of people at the RNC, I was quite surprised. You know, I'm no friend of the Republicans, you know, personally, and I find you know, their use of this sort of usually of God and family language, you know, I find it's to me quite often obnoxious, or it's morally repugnant to me.
Yeah, usually it's code. It's code for something else.
Exactly. Yeah. It's code for something else. Yeah. And we know what. So, and it's identitarian in particular, in the way it codes for something else. This one isn't. Yeah. Trump's speech actually eschewed those identity markers, as did, I think, J.D. Vance's. So it's about something bigger here. Now, on just straight policy side, I'm really quite hopeful from it, or I think it was good. Just thinking about it, because you know, from the outside and in terms of foreign policy, there's a kind of distaste for war emerging again, right? The anti-war thing, which actually buoyed the Obama candidacy, and then Sanders won as well. It's always there, and each time people use it, you know, draw on it and then screw with it and betray it. I don't know if it might happen again, but it's here again. It's not on the Democratic side, certainly. So Trump's, you know, recital of, you note how he talks about the adversaries or the enemies, whether Russia or, he mentioned Russia, Iran, no mention of China, interestingly. Vance, who focuses on China, definitely wants to get out of Ukraine. But then the focus is on economic competition and economic rivalry. Hey, that's fine with the Chinese, man. You know, yeah. Make it economic, make it about fixing yourselves. So, you know, it just this, in straight foreign policy terms, the Ukraine project is screwed if these guys get in. Because another very influential figure around Trump, a key figure, actually, advisor, is Tucker Carlson. He's no longer a Fox host. He's not, you know, he's no longer beholden. He's not a journalist, kind of a paid up member of sort of the journalistic.
I think David Sachs, right?
He's on his own, and he's turned into the strange thing. He's a kind of advisor
donor,
to him,
right? So David Sachs is a major.
David Sachs is a major donor. Yeah,
who's
Trump has got, also got some of these. Yeah, those people
Ukraine
that you think
war,
are on the.
Yeah.
That you think that, yeah, all anti Ukraine war.
Carl, what's
really
your take on the geopolitical sort of? Well,
yeah.
What's your view? I think on the way that I guess the Russians and Chinese view Trump right now, because I feel like Dugin, for example, has really praised Trump as legible, as meaning like we can understand this person. I don't know if they like him or not, but it seems like they at least recognize some sort of human legibility in it.
That's a great word.
Well, I think, you know, it's pretty clear the Trump policy is to ease up on the Ukraine war. And this is what everybody expected. But how much he will be able to do, you know, to actually carry it out, that's remained to be seen. And there has always been a contingent in the U.S. foreign policy establishment that wanted to do like a reverse Kissinger. They wanted to make up with Russia and to get Russia either remain neutral, but better yet, to ally with the United States to contain China. Like that's what John Mearsheimer has been talking about for the longest time. Of course, John Mearsheimer, you know, was not listened to because the NATO bureaucracy needs to justify its employment, its own employment. But looks like there we might see attempt in that direction. But then again, you know, I expect they will run into a lot of resistance with the deep state, because we saw that with the first Trump administration, right? We saw, you know, at that time where Trump was talking about reset in the Russian relations, but the Democrats raised a huge stink about this totally bogus Russiagate story. In the end, Trump ended up expelling Russian diplomat, and the relationship actually got worse. So I'm still taking the wait and see attitude. You know, it's interesting what the rhetorics are at this point, but I'm going to have to see some implementations first. And I don't.
What about
think
from the Chinese
Russian
side?
Well, this Chinese side is very interesting, because I was watching the state. I was getting a lot of the tweets from people working in the Chinese state media, like, you know, Xinhua in particular. And I noticed these people are uniformly tweeting the speech by J.D. Vance, you know, both from yesterday and today. Hmm. And they were stressing the, you know, there was a part where J.D. Vance said, look, China, before that, he said China spent money to eradicate poverty. They were doing Belt and Road initiative, and this is what we should do.
Oh, in a separate speech. You're saying in a separate speech. Yes, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So they were stressing that part. So I think the Chinese side are they're already seeing, like, you know, okay, Trump is probably going to win, and they're probably signaling. I think this is a signal. They're signaling their willingness to work with a new incoming Trump administration. You know, by highlighting all the parts they find positive about J.D. Vance's speech. Even though we know J.D. Vance has other agendas, you know, like, but the overwhelming focus on the positive, you know, the put a positive spin on it, if you will. I think it's the Chinese way of signaling that they're willing to deal with Trump. I don't know if that signal will be received by, you know, because half of the time Americans are totally tone deaf to, you know, the Chinese overture, especially very subtle one at that. And also the, you know, that for Trump and J.D. Vance, they're more concerned with their domestic constituency at this point. You know, first they got to still get to win the election. Still need the votes, and a lot of that is, you know, J.D. Vance is basically going the traditional route, kind of blaming China for loss of blue collar jobs in United States. Rather, you know, he did share some blame to the Wall Street. You know, he kind of split the difference 50-50. He blamed the Wall Street, but he also blamed the Chinese Communist Party, because that's what plays to the crowd. But I want to see, you know, I see that this is a thing, right? There's a lot of excitement about J.D. Vance, but what is the office of vice presidency anyway? Like, what does Kamala Harris ever do? What does Joe Biden ever do when he's in office?
Carl, I think they should view J.D. Vance, I think right now, as the, you know, the likely successor and the next nominee in 2028.
Absolutely.
You're looking at the successor, the heir. And I really think J.D. Vance is going to be a major political figure in the United States. I think I'm really impressed by, I think the different, here's the thing, Carl, and I don't know if Chinese care about this, which they probably shouldn't. They should kind of black box the United States a little bit and just kind of think of us as, you know, a sort of like monolithic structure without much going on in the inside. Okay, I get that. But from the inside, you know, Trump is a very different kind of politician right now, especially now, where I think that he believes himself to be a sort of divine patriarch, or almost like a king figure. I don't think he's going to be as concerned with his polls the way Joe Biden is. I know Joe Biden has a reputation basically for analyzing every single decision through the lens of polling. That's all he cares about. I think recently there's been reports that Obama has pressured Biden to step down. Biden has started to come around to the idea, but he said, I want to see the polling on Kamala first. That's how they run things over there. That's standard transactional politics. I think you have much more gut level politics going on in the Trump camp. And my hope, my optimism here, and I know people will shit on optimism, which is fine, because I'm optimistic, but I hope for the best, but I expect the worst. Let's put it that way. Is that of all the potential politicians to take the helm, I think a second term, you know, post post Deus Ex Machina Trump might be one of the most independent and, you know, poll agnostic presidents that we've seen. I think actually the way out for America in a lot of this is to have a very strong, independent, and in a way, because, you know, in a way, a truly autocratic leader with a temp, you know, penned in, of course, by constitution and term limits. But the fact is that that is what the office of the president is when it comes to foreign policy. He is absolutely a dictator. Inside these borders, he's severely constrained by checks and balances vis-a-vis primarily Congress, and also the Supreme Court, of course. But Congress is the major obstacle. But when it comes to foreign policy, outside the borders, the president is just as much an iron-fisted autocrat as any of his rivals on the world stage.
But do you think, but do you think Joe Biden right now is dictating the terms of U.S.
Exactly. That's my point, is that we're having these weak, fucking pathetic, poll-obsessed leaders who don't know how to handle that power. Every decision he makes,
it's unaccountable, it's unconstrained power.
And there's no...
Yeah, it's monarchical power.
Right,
Even if it's subverted, it's monarchical.
Yeah.
Somebody has subverted it, but it's still monarchical power.
He is
in foreign policy
an incredible amount of power, but without any sense of true... He doesn't have any will. You know, like, he doesn't know how to make up his fucking mind. You know, he's granted an incredible amount of power, and look at the amount of fucking damage and suffering and chaos he's been spreading. And honestly, I know they call him Genocide Joe. I know everyone thinks he's evil. I think he's just completely feckless and useless. I think that's his main problem, is that he just doesn't know what the fuck he's doing, and he doesn't really want to do anything. He just wants to rely on poll feedback to guide him. Because he's got this stupid childlike faith in polls and the democratic process when it, you know, but basically polls.
Yeah, but John Biden doesn't even know what he's talking about 5 minutes ago. He's just like a zombie president. He looks like the deep state is actually running things, you know, like look like people like Jake Sullivan, you know, his national security advisor, is actually running the U.S. foreign policy, you know, all the strategizing in Europe, in Ukraine, and then all the maneuver in Middle East, and also in the Pacific versus China. I don't think Biden is fully, you know, in charge
in control
of that. Yeah,
that's one of the problems, Carl.
Is that
if your president isn't exercising true will and authority over the levers of power, then you're going to get unaccountable weasels and, corrupted partisans and, all that stuff taking over and making moves, but being entirely unaccountable. So, I think you're right, Carl. I think a lot of other people are making decisions.
So you have this war machine. Yeah. I mean,
I
speak to Carl's point here, but by appointing Vance and having such a coherent sort of relationship, right, between the two here, he's providing a 10-year run for reform. It doesn't, you know, if you're going to have hope in reform in the U.S., this is it. It doesn't get any better than this.
Yeah.
Okay.
If he had appointed somebody like Nikki Haley or Marco Rubio, it would be very, it'd be very different. You see the return of business as usual after Trump, right?
I'm gonna play the devil's advocate here. I'm gonna be the cynical guy here. J.D. Vance, right? His advancement into politics was sponsored by Peter Thiel, right? I mean, this is
Let's get on that.
So Peter.
Yep.
So I mean, wouldn't you think that would be, you know, his foreign policy, whatever, would be more in line with, say, Peter Thiel? And, you know, I actually met Peter Thiel personally.
What is Thiel's foreign policy? I don't really follow that.
Me too.
Thiel is he doesn't like China. And he's
who
very
likes China? Nobody in America likes China.
That's
who
true.
Likes China in America?
but for Peter, it's more, it's ideological, you know. He really truly believe you know, China is authoritarian, authoritarian dystopia, and it must be contained. And I don't know how much that would rub off on J.D. Vance. As far as I can tell, J.D. Vance is a very versatile all-American politician. That means he's very flexible. I mean, he went from never Trumper in 2016 to become, like, you know, the VP pick in 2024.
Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I mean that's a neutral thing. I mean, it could either be good or it could be bad. It, by itself, it doesn't mean anything. It just means that he's a consummate politician. You know, he doesn't necessarily have a. He's not ideological, which is good, but it also means, you know, like he will change with whichever way the political wind is blowing, you know, whatever fit his interest, which is what most politicians do. So again, you know, as long as Trump remain healthy and fully in full possession of his mental faculties, you know, sure, J.D. Vance might be lined up for the next election to be the nominee, but I don't see him do much in the next four years. You know, if you look at the vice presidency of...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think his significance is simply as someone who's you know, going to be meant to take over.
Right. Yeah. So I'm still... take a wait and see attitude to where what's actually how is going to play out. And first of all, we are just counting the chicken before the eggs are hatched here. You know, Trump hasn't been elected yet. Like I said, there's still 4 months, still a long way to go before the next Trump presidency.
Hey, we're just talking about our favorite show, you know, America. Hey, should we take some?
Yeah, agreed.
I want to hear that from the guy who keep on doing the downvote, and just yeah. Want to know why he's keep
downvoting. Yeah, downvote guy. Pedro, you're on, man. You can unmute yourself, and you're a speaker now.
That was the end of the main part of this Twitter space. If you want to listen to the rest of the discussion with some of the other participants in that space, that'll be on the Patreon feed. Go to patreon.com/planningmag if you want access.